So just to refresh my memory, because I haven't thought about this stuff for a long time, I actually picked up some old annual reports, and one of which, one document of which I thought was really interesting, because this is the 1978 shareholders agreement that established MDA, International Mobile Data, Tom Purdy, LDevCo, as the initial shareholders, with the grand total of 25,000 shares to Purdy at a tenth of a penny a share. LDevCo, which was Bill Thompson, you know these people
right.
are, right?
Yes.
Bill Thompson.
Yes.
And at the total, MDI will issue a 617,000 shares at our par value. So, you know, I look at this and I said, God, what a simple document. I mean, compared to what you'd have to do today, and then they had other, you know, bits and pieces in terms of the, you know, non-disclosure and all that stuff.
Yeah. So is this and the incorporation document or a shareholder?
No, it just was a shareholders agreement from 1978. So there was this one. The other one, which is sort of fun to look at, this was the actual offer to purchase for cash. Now, have you ever thought of seeing this document is all of, 28 pages. Well, 29 if you put the back page with all the names on it. And can you imagine a takeover offer today? It would be probably, you know, 150 pages to begin with, right? But this was the offer at $13.50 a share for mobile data from Motorola.
Very good.
In what the hell is the date on this thing? It was
1988.
Yeah, it's 1988. So I just thought it was humorous. May 16th, 1988. Somewhat humorous to sort of have a look at these and realize that at that time, that's all you really had to do. This was the deal. Mm. And that was it. And then in not that one so much as if we go back to the early years, which is when I was involved. So
yes.
So the very early days, you know, the sales in 1980 were $400,000. 81 was 2 million, and we made a profit.
Right.
And then that was my last year, and then Barclay took over going forward. But the stage had been set with Federal Express in particular as a contract, and we delivered several systems. Chicago being the main one because it was a full up and running demo. A demo in their sense, but an operating system for them that they were functioning with. And then if you look, it went 2, 4, 8, 25, right?
Mm.
So
good growth.
So fantastic growth, right? Yes. And and what was also rather interesting is it really came down to the bottom line too. You know, from 100,000 went four times the profit. This is four times the profit, and this is twice the profit.
Mm-hmm.
So then, you know, you go beyond that. But it was very interesting to see it take off in that way. So these are just another sort of historical things. You know, if you. Just for fun, if you want to have that page, you can have it.
I'm curious what happened to some of these things, because I remember, did you come to the open house we had just as the building was being closed? It was back about 4 years ago.
No.
We had some of the old
Oh, really?
at that time.
Yeah, it would have been neat.
Along with the old artifacts. I'm curious what happened, because I think, I know the gold was donated to MDSI.
Oh, right, sure.
And I think some of the other documents may have gone with it.
It's quite likely. I mean, they would have had them there. But, you also look back at that era. I mean, these weren't too bad, but the first, and it always bothered me, but the first, Barclay, but the first terminals were pretty, I mean, compared to today, they're pretty clunky. But it was a dedicated terminal at the time. You know, you didn't have the laptop market to borrow on, so that was it. But.
Anyway, if we can get started, let me just reposition this a little bit. So let me point to you. I can always re-record me if I don't get that right. What I'd like to do is just sort of walk through some of the history. I've made some notes on things I'm aware of, and we can fill in the gaps. So as just... sort of way how you came to get involved in the MDI in the first place. You were working, as I understand, at MDA. So maybe starting from your background, you went to McGill University, and then you worked at CP Rail. I had
correct.
And
right.
That brought you to Vancouver, I believe.
Yes.
Yes. And how do you then get involved in the wireless data project?
Oh, because I'd always had an interest in venture capital, mm-hmm. and so shortly after coming, well, I'd been in Vancouver, I guess, about a year or so. And I was keen to go and experience more of the venture capital world and remove myself from the very large, more bureaucratic world of Canadian Pacific. And so there was, I had done a little study when I was doing my MBA program. I looked at venture capital,
uh-huh.
and had looked at a number of firms across the country on doing, looking what they were investing in and what their returns were. And principles of venture capital,
mm-hmm.
and one of the firms was Ventures West, and so I,
mm-hmm.
when I decided that I was looking for other opportunities, I went back to that and said, oh, well, Ventures West is here, why don't mm-hmm. I go and have a chat with them?
Right. Uh-huh.
And Ventures West was a very interesting younger organization with some real entrepreneurs in it, you know, Mike Brown, Haig Ferris, and they had made this investment. I just showed you this document. So they'd signed up and they made this investment, and MDI had, I think Purdy was the first president,
mm-hmm.
but that wasn't the role that he chose. He just happened to take it on. I think there was nobody else to do it at the time, but he really wanted to turn it over to someone else, which they did.
Mm-hmm.
And he wasn't keen on. I mean, he was used to a much larger organization, so
mm-hmm.
the small entity
mm-hmm.
wasn't really fitting well,
mm-hmm.
and so they had this investment and they had a situation where it hadn't sold product yet, except the demo that they'd done for the Vancouver Police,
mm-hmm.
and I was coming out of admittedly a totally different business on an operational side.
Uh-huh.
But I had an interest in venture capital, and for, I guess, whatever reason, they said, all right, why don't you come and join us,
mm-hmm.
which I did, and then we'll give you these assignments, which they did, and MDI was one of them. There was another one, which is a hilarious story, if you ever want to do a story, on a thing called Freeing Screen, but anyway, it's the longest in the past, but Mike Brown can just tell hilarious stories about the start of that. Is most of these young,
mm-hmm.
early startup companies, your own included, I'm sure, have great stories around their formation and
yes.
early stage. Once they get going, you know, there's
yeah.
mm-hmm. things settle down a little bit. But in any case, they essentially said, look, you know, just go out to Richmond, and they didn't even go out with me. I remember they just said, here's the address, just drive out there and, you know, see what you can do. And
mm-hmm.
that was about the strength of the mandate. And
mm-hmm.
and one thing led to another, and so I became president of it, and we got things cranked up. And there was a
mm-hmm.
core of some very good people
mm-hmm.
there, about four. There were five or six people there when I joined,
uh-huh.
and there were about 40 people there when I left. And we
right.
were profitable
mm-hmm.
in 81,
mm-hmm.
and so I was there about 2 years, and then at that time it was clear that there was a number of things. The environment was changing,
right. uh-huh.
And so here was this company within the portfolio that was now clearly making some progress. And there was an opportunity, because MDA was going through some complicated throws, and Barclay was very close to Thompson and Purdy,
mm-hmm.
and gee, I'm looking around for something else to do. So my role to sort of get it turned around and running
right.
had been pretty
mm-hmm.
much completed. It was profitable,
mm-hmm.
and so they said, so Barclay, why don't you like to come involved? Which of course he said he would, and he then dragged along with him a whole number of people. One guy called Doug, I can't remember his last name, who was became a development officer, CFO,
mm-hmm.
and a number of people
yeah. Yeah.
that came over from MDA and joined. And so there was a
mm-hmm.
A remarkable opportunity to pull together rapidly
mm-hmm.
a cohesive team.
Right. Uh-huh. Yes.
And the other part of the puzzle that I think helped to propel it forward was that there was a very good salesman in the company who's still in the technology business here, Peter Ciccone.
Okay.
And Peter was there as sales, but he was much more the salesperson than perhaps the marketing person. And so we wanted to expand the sales marketing arena, and I was count as one of my successes, attracting
talent.
attracting a really good person to join the company, and so and my mind has now gone blank. But anyway. Here we are. Okay, so there was marketing and
don't worry about the pauses. We can edit those out. So
okay.
Yeah.
So anyway, that person was Faroze Rizal.
Oh yes. Okay.
And Faroze was, you know, was clearly a potential star, and that's really why, you know, a year or so after Motorola took over MDI, mm-hmm. he was selected to say, look, why don't you come and run another thing called Ballard, and he's did that spectacularly. Mm-hmm. So Faroze really rose through the ranks and mm-hmm. carried on, and it was interesting because you had people who were there at the inception mm-hmm. who didn't or wouldn't have had the larger organizational experience to take it
right.
next step.
Yes.
But by bringing Barclay in, and then by him bringing in these other people who always sort of, they knew the MDA processes and
right.
the project management, because mm-hmm. MDA was pure project management.
Yes.
They knew about those things, and they knew about systems, and they knew a whole bunch of things that were
right.
very useful.
Yes.
And to bring them in knowing each other, so they didn't have to figure out, well, is this person going to be able to do it or not? It meant that it was a very successful
mm-hmm.
transition, and it's one of those, you know, they talk about companies going through stages, you know. So
right.
they went through
mm-hmm.
the first stage, it's profitable.
Mm-hmm.
The next
yes.
stage was accelerated growth. It clearly
mm-hmm.
showed up here. The next stage was sort of a consolidation and more complexity because
mm-hmm.
they got into very large systems, and then they grew internationally. So now you had to service Sweden, and you had to service the U.S., and you had to, you know, all of those things in England, ultimately.
Right.
And then you had the matrix of regional requirements as well as technology requirements. So it was taxi cabs in London, and it was taxi
right.
cabs in Japan,
yes.
and it was police in yeah. Sweden. And so you had to be then look at these different marketing mm. sectors.
So I didn't realize that Barclay had come from MDA. Background. I knew that originally there was the Vancouver police project, which was the pilot you talked about,
mm-hmm.
and presumably the four or five people that were in at the start were involved in that project as part of MDA, so they came from MDA also, did they?
No.
No?
Mm-hmm.
No,
there was
a
well,
sort of genesis came
a
about?
Little bit, it's a little vague, but he sent it, so. So MDA was, there was a really excellent program at the time called the Unsolicited Proposal Program.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and Ken Spencer was a master at this, which he then proved to be further a master when he went and formed his own company with Dan sometime later.
Mm-hmm.
And Dan Gelbert, who was just a wizard at these things, had ideas that in fact, you know, data was the way to go, and you needed to have an error-correcting modem, and you had all these issues of errors that would creep in otherwise. And he figured out that there was some pretty interesting algorithms you could apply to solve those problems. So I think it was Ken probably who would have had the task role at MDA to go and do an unsolicited proposal to get some government money, which is why in the early days of MDI, and I did deal with them, there was a organization called Canadian Patents and Development Limited, CPDL,
mm-hmm.
in Ottawa, from whom, once they did this unsolicited proposal, CPDL would own the technology and then license it back, and so you paid a royalty to them,
uh-huh.
a certain amount, which we paid off.
Yes.
And so they had this, but then became clear that this project was really, it had to move out of the systems arena of MDA at the time into a product-oriented company.
Mm-hmm.
So they said, well, why don't we create MDI?
Mm-hmm.
And so between Purdy and of course, Mike Brown and Haig
mm-hmm.
and a few others, they said, fine, let's set up this new company. And so
mm-hmm.
so MDA then assigned this to them for some shares and some interest. And so
mm-hmm.
so
yep.
you had, let me just check that, right? So so that's why you have MDA in here, right?
So MDA so owned part of
the so MDA had an interest in it, right? Mm-hmm. So 50,000 shares to MDA at the grand price of a tenth of a cent a share. They definitely made money on that.
Yes.
Right? Uh-huh. So they had 50,000 shares and it went to Motorola at 1350. Mm-hmm. There you go. As a result, you had this technology which came out, and Dan, being he's a marvelous educator and teacher as well, kept a very strong interest in the company throughout its entire life in Vancouver. Mm-hmm. And was always there to answer questions and explain things and help out. Mm-hmm. And in it was Dan who went over. We were trying to sell a unit to the British police, who had severe troubles in Ireland at the time. Mm-hmm. And but they needed to have these computer access terminals in the vehicles, but they needed to have them very well hidden. Mm-hmm. And disguised. And the story goes that it was Dan Gelbert in a hotel room in somewhere outside of London, who was shown, well, you know, here's the car and here's your box, which of course wasn't conformed at all to do, mm-hmm. you know, to fit in. I mean, we hadn't known going over there. I wasn't on the trip, but they hadn't known going over there what exactly the parameters were. Finally, you know, very secretive. This is what we're talking about, gentlemen. This is all secret. You're not to tell anybody. But we needed to fit into this little space. Uh-huh. And Dan, who, you know, always would carry some tools with him, who, you know, cut up the board and did something else and soldered something else. And in the morning, they had a box that fit into the sink, right? So he'd actually transformed this thing overnight to function and fit within that. And one thing led to another and some other work. We did a lot of work with Plessy in England, of course, who became the valued partner. So it was a great growth in this period. I mean, Federal Express was the first and most, you know, very significant strategic partner.
Right.
But beyond that, people like Plessy also became very significant strategic partners. And so there was a whole, in terms of marketing and business development, there was a whole series of significant negotiations as you built up these strategic partners. And there was the acronym. There was a company in SDC Japan was working in Japan. Mm-hmm. We worked with them, Plessy in England, mm-hmm. and quite a number of others. And there was another company that worked. Provider of systems into police and fire in the U.S. and you know, for example, helped sell into the Phoenix Fire Department. Yes. And these sorts of things. So as the business started to grow, you needed those prime agents. Mm-hmm. And it was quite an interesting learning curve at that point as well, because these systems had to interface and the standards weren't always set. And so you had lots of interesting challenges.
So I guess FedEx was really the breakthrough that really propelled
FedEx was bar none the historical mm-hmm. breakthrough, because they would put things onto a commercial track. They were building their own business. They could respond rapidly, whereas if you were selling into a police and fire, you'd have a whole budget process that would then be next year and mm-hmm. number of things. So the sales cycle issues in the public sector are quite different from that in the private one. Mm-hmm. Fred Smith was really in high gear at the time, and in fact it was one of his people who really identified and was looking around for this solution. Mm-hmm. And we did, at that point in time, of course, you didn't have the internet.
Yes.
You had word of mouth and whatever. And mm-hmm. he found MDI and said, look, is this what you do? Can you do this? And there were two or three others. There was a data system company out of California.
So he approached you rather than you looking for...
So he had made an inquiry mm-hmm. to say, is this something that you can do? Mm-hmm. And that inquiry had come in, oh gosh, just a couple of months, I think, before I got there. But the company didn't have any money to really respond. You know, they talk about, you know, what's your sales funnel? Well, there were only two or three drops in the funnel, and one of them was FedEx. And I guess I was strongly motivated to find some piece of business.
Mm-hmm.
And so the three of us, Peter Ciccone, myself, and I don't know if it was Steve Wiley or Mike that came with me anyway. Three of us went down and spent a few days in Memphis, Tennessee with FedEx.
Mm-hmm.
And we took down an operating base station and two terminals. And we had to sort of a vow on the plane, we're not bringing them back. They have to stay there. And sure enough, they did. And they ended up running in a little test system. And by God, it all worked. And that led to the Chicago test. So that was the, but that was a real turning point. Mm-hmm. The other turning point, I don't know if I'm rambling too much here, but I always enjoy telling the story because Mike Brown tells it at Adventures West. I mean, they put more money in, and I had a dual responsibility at both Ventures West and, of course, at MDI. So I knew what these guys were thinking in terms of, well, how much money will we invest in this little company? It hasn't gone very far so far. And one of the issues that you have in these companies is, and others were beating up on us about it, was, oh, this little company's going to be out of business tomorrow. You know, why would you buy from them? They won't be around. It won't work. Who's going to service it? All those questions. And one of the problems too was that FedEx had said, well, if we wanted to buy stuff, I mean, we're going to buy, you know, 40 terminals a week. What are you guys? How are you going to do this, right? And Barclay can tell you phenomenal stories of flying people to Japan and with a suitcase, empty suitcase, flying there, no clothes, bring back chips, right? And we need them tomorrow, and so you're going to go there, you're going to buy them, and here's your money, and you're going to get on the plane and fly them back with you, right? But we weren't quite at that stage, but we were at a stage where we had to design, build, test, and have these things running in high temperatures and on shakers and all the sort of things, you know, sort of durability, and be prepared to go and ship them so that when, in fact, an order came, you could respond and at least give the appearance that you were larger than you were.
Mm-hmm.
And that was an important one. And you know, Mike always tells a story of, you know, there was a partners meeting, you know, and do we put more money into this thing? And by God, there was, I walked in with an order from Federal Express and say, look, they want 40 for Chicago. And I say, oh, okay, so we'll put the money in. But it was down to, you know, we've got 2 weeks burn rate.
Mm-hmm.
But where some of the cash went that I'd been pulling out of Ventures West was to go into building a whole suites of terminals that were sitting in the back room,
mm-hmm.
without the ROM in them.
Right. Uh-huh.
And so when the order came in, it was just a question of doing the final programming for what the interface and output would look like on the screen,
mm-hmm.
burning the ROMs, putting them in, and shipping them.
Right.
And the other thing I like to tell is that at that time, the Royal Bank was also keen on helping the technology community. Oh, it still is, you know, Vic is there. What they had was an arrangement for factoring shipments.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went to them and I set up, and they said, well, it depends who the customer is. So the customer is FedEx. They probably got a pretty good credit rating. So we set up a factoring arrangement with the Royal Bank,
mm-hmm.
such that we'd get about 70% of the shipped value of the goods,
mm-hmm.
within 24 hours of the shipment. We just had to show them that we'd actually shipped the goods.
Uh-huh.
And so there was a remarkable turnaround in the cash, because all of a sudden we had FedEx orders coming in,
mm-hmm.
and we had a Royal Bank letter of credit, or if you're factoring arrangement.
Right.
Such that was cash in the door.
Yeah.
And the company never looked back.
Mm-hmm.
Because that, you know, you have that and you say, my God, now we've got to raise money because we've got to build these things.
Right.
And Ventures West had been, in their entrepreneurial style, they then had very supportive and trusting, actually, you know, of the, I guess, of management of MDI.
Mm-hmm.
And so you had a combination of events that all fit.
So I guess it was very good from a cash flow point of view, and I understand that's how they came to buy the building down on Number 5 Road, because they became had a lot of surplus cash.
Cash flow kept rolling in, and
the
other thing to remember, of course, is that we didn't have $1,000 gigabyte laptops. So if you wanted to put a computer in a car with error correction and everything else, it was worth a lot of money. So there was a tremendous value. There was a huge value seen well beyond the component price of these things.
Yes.
And so the entire system had significant value in each of the applications. Maybe more in the security than it does in the taxi, but nevertheless. Mm-hmm. What it meant is that you could price it quite well. Mm-hmm. And the system, and once the system became replicated, so you could, you knew what you had to change and what was becoming more of a platform. Mm-hmm. There would have been pretty good leverage on the pricing, as you can mm-hmm. see. I mean, you can look at this,
right.
Look at the growth and profit in the early days, and so I went on. I mean, I was on the board until it was taken over by Motorola, mm-hmm. and indeed, I mean, the cash flow continued to come in, and so mm-hmm. the question is, well, look, if we want to lease as much space as we think we need, it's going to cost us mm-hmm. this, and so the you run the models and analysis, mm-hmm. and it became more attractive, and clearly more attractive if you think about selling the building later on at some better price.
Motorola was done sometime later. They did sell the building and lease it on a leaseback arrangement.
Right.
That a cash situation that arose?
Well, I think at that time, and I can't remember what year that was, but So the least dilutive, if you wish, thing to do for all the shareholders was, in fact, to sell the building and lease it back.
Mm-hmm.
And so then you had this nice influx of cash, which had to go, because there was a, as you moved to each level, you had to establish foreign offices, and you had to, it was also getting into businesses where, as I say, there were pretty long lead times. The sales cycle was fairly long.
Mm-hmm.
Although they were larger and larger sales, but you had to have the working capital, and so it was one way to go ahead and raise that without having to do the pricing of a financing at the time. Mm-hmm.
There was also quite a social network or culture at the company. Did you see much of that? The events such as the golf tournament, the sailing, and the
that was wonderful. I wasn't really part of that. It came in with Barclay and a group of people from MDA, and they worked hard and they play hard, and that was very much the culture. I mean, if you go back to, we're talking now the mid '80s, pretty much most high tech companies were like that. I mean, the computer, digital equipment, for example, was really well known and for it. And Dennis Connor was at MDA, and these guys. I mean, So I mean, it was all. There was a very, very social element, and people got along well and worked hard. And I mean, you were spending long and late hours working, the social and good time side of it was one way of rewarding employees for their hard work and determination.
Yeah, I think some companies in town are still advancing that work hard and play hard idea.
Well, if you look at what Electronic Arts has done, I mean, they've perfected it, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
They've got lots of good things.
So, just talking about the manufacturing, were you in there in the days when they were crunching to get the orders out? There was stories about management working on the production lines to get the products out. Was that part of your day?
Yeah, certainly, in the first couple of years, I mean, again, Barclay and his team and the thing grew, but everybody pretty much had to pitch in. Steve Wiley, who was a software engineer, but he also had a very good hardware bent to him. And he was solving hardware problems and software problems. Mike Creswell was doing the software engineering. I mean, it was a small team of a few people, right? And then
mm-hmm.
we had one fellow who ran the testing labs and all these sorts of things. So everyone had to pitch in when it was time to build these things and get them out the door. There wasn't a sophisticated production line. And if you go back, it's interesting, it's Mike Volker Craig.
Oh, yes.
If you visited him about the same era when he was beginning to build computer terminals, display
mm-hmm.
terminals, I mean, they were building computer terminals at Volker Craig in Waterloo on pieces of plywood
mm-hmm.
and rolling them down conveyors, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's how they went from station to station. I mean, it was not very picturesque, mm-hmm. right, compared to what you'd expect today. So we did the same sort of thing. We had for example, when I was there, we built up, and somebody went down. There was another guy there called Norm Dick. I have no idea. Norm went on to do all sorts of brilliant technology things. He was British, and he found somewhere a device to a shaker table, because we wanted to shake these things continuously because they were going to be in vehicles and the vibration would be continuous for their life. So, did some deal and picked this tremendous unit up that would just put you'd bolt on four of them and they'd be vibrating all night long. And we kept the heat on, and it was high temperatures, so we wanted to run things at a fairly extreme side of operating capabilities and just make sure that they tested out. And obviously some failed, but most of them worked, and it helped us continue to improve. There was, I mean, that was one of the areas, I'd say it was adequate, but it was adequate. You could ship the products, but ultimately they had to go, and probably when Barclay, in the early years that Barclay was there, I suspect they had to do a great deal more in terms of redesign and QC to make it even more robust. But that's the nature of all new product introductions.
So were you around when the first handheld portable devices, was that part of FedEx?
No. I mean, it came, FedEx wanted that, but I mean, I was there right at the early 2 years, and so ours was really just a terminal. They were just beginning to get into something that they could, a fellow could carry with them and have as a wand and this sort of thing. Mm-hmm.
There was also, I had an organization called MIT, which was part of MDI. Do you know anything about that?
No.
That was the research arm, and I was curious why it was structured that way. Maybe moving on from a little bit from MDI, you've had other wireless adventures with Hyperbolt Voice, I believe.
Right. I don't know how wireless that is, but it was on the it's an internet payment systems.
Right. I understand it was. Originally, the idea was to use SMS and make it a wireless transaction. That didn't come about at all.
There were several. I think. You really should talk to Lisa about that.
Yes.
She's had a number of ideas in terms of payments and phone services that would enable payments, but the company's core business was all around, in fact, an online banking transaction where you're really dealing straight from a laptop or a desktop machine.
Okay. Yeah. I know she's made presentations at NBC, and I thought there was a wireless connection there. So were you part of that organization for a while?
A couple of years.
Through Ventures West?
No. I left Ventures West in 19. Shortly after the MDA deal, actually. In terms of the wireless, the issues again is if you go back to the 2001 when I was at HyperWallet, the issues there were turning this thing around that was surviving through the horrific fallout of 1999, 2000, and it was a real focus on bankable. Near banking transactions, so credit union transactions, eBay sales, this sort of thing, and it was in an interesting spot. If you look at what's going on in Canada now in terms of online transactions and the continual growth of the use of computers to do your shopping and your payments, it's in a good space. It also moved into the whole card business. So you're into cards that enable you to go to an ATM machine and pull money out of your account. So it's gone into the card business, and it's got also into the affinity card business as well, and is doing quite well, and has a new president, as you know. Jim Mutter is president there.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yes, I saw that had changed. Could I ask you a little bit more about your later career and what you've done since the MDI years? You were involved in.
That was a long time ago.
Yes, it was.
It's a long time ago. Yeah.
You were president of ASI for a time, I know.
That was, yeah, that was 2002 to 2004. Mm-hmm. So that was a very interesting time, and it was
a lot of companies.
But it also was you know, it was also shut down, so it mm-hmm. was I guess you could say it was it was characterized as a merger with Science Council, but the programs for which ASI had become known and very popular with were all terminated at that time. So it remains to be seen what will what'll happen, what will transpire in terms of replacing some of those, if any.
About the time I read, you made some statements about the wireless industry in the future, with the Olympics coming along. It seemed to be a very optimistic outlook. Is that?
Do you have a reference to that?
Yes, I do.
Is that right? What did I say?
I didn't bring a copy of it, but you were it was an article about I think it was at the time when the bid was being put together for the Olympic Games, and we were talking about how wireless would be a part of that.
Right, and I still think that's uh-huh. absolutely correct.
Right.
I think it's hard to know the priorities, if you wish, of the people running VanOck and all. You know, they've got so many other issues they have to deal with, but clearly. It seemed to me, if I vaguely recall, I think what you're referring to, the idea looking ahead was that there was an opportunity to showcase a whole number of wireless devices and accessibilities and interoperabilities, and to enable people to see the scores and see the images and all those things. And if I think about it now, and I haven't for a while, but if you think about it now, we've got many, many more systems out there, mm-hmm. all with perhaps pieces of the puzzle. Mm-hmm. I'm carrying around my BlackBerry, so can I see real time on the BlackBerry? Let's see the ski jumping real time and mm-hmm. that sort of thing. And so I think there was a tremendous opportunity to try to bring together and come up with a number of showcase type mm-hmm. products or services. The issue with that grand scheme, of course, is that it takes a fair amount of effort, and I think the theme that might have happened along the way is people come back and say, what's your focus? What's your business focus? Mm-hmm. And so even though one might see it as a showcasing opportunity, and for example, this hydrogen highway concept is one of them. But at the end of the day, after 2 weeks, when everybody leaves and goes home again, what's the piece of business that the company's left with, and what are they going to do with it, and what was the investment that they had to make to get there as a showcase?
Right. Yes.
And that's the real challenge. And so I think, given the strengths of wireless data and capabilities in the city and the province, it would have been interesting to see what things might have been done around that. Mm-hmm. But I have no idea. I haven't followed it, and so I have no idea how far it's got, but I can see I can see the other side of the coin, which is, well, look, you know, we've got these other priorities, and that's because we've got these business pieces. Now, what's this going to do for us?
So
I don't know how far it went.
Certainly, right now, through in BC, there is this organization called WinLab that's being set up, and Bell.
WinLab or LAP?
WinLab.
Okay,
yeah.
All right.
And that's being funded partly by, as I understand it, Bell, and also the federal government, and I think the provincial
right.
government
good.
Is putting
yeah.
some money. So
yeah.
They have a mandate, which is basically to keep them with the funding that has been committed for running for about 4 years.
Mm.
And the idea is that that will be a place to showcase
that's
some
great.
Of this technology.
Yeah. Yeah, Bell set up a venture fund 2002 or 2003. There was some announcement of a new fund, and it was the whole purpose of it was to look downstream at potential Bell related products. They really had, you know, there was various senses about it. One was, well, they'll fund lots of things in the wireless space. The other one was, no, it's only if it's going to help them sell their products. But that's, I'm delighted to hear that, because I think they, the spirit of that deal, if I recollect vaguely what the terms were, the spirit of it was certainly right to assist in some of these smaller firms to develop some interesting things. And there's some great people around town in the wireless space at this point, and to try to engage them in something that would be a great great idea.
So, given I guess your background, do you see any opportunities that are there? You talk about things like being able to watch events or get information on your cell phone. Are there any specific opportunities that you think niche opportunities that exist within that space? With the Olympics coming along,
I don't know if it's I don't know. It seems that there's what's happened is the cell phone capability is just with the SMS and that sort of information has just taken over. So the question is how do you superimpose on SMSs the images that you want, and have you got the bandwidth and sort of thing? So I think. You know, if you can work on things like compression, so you can get that image out there, and clarity, so you can actually see it even on a small cell phone. That's some of the problems, or really is how do you display, how do you move around? One of the companies, not so much in the wireless space, but it's in the display space, was is a company that developed a very very interesting display module, so that when you moved this module over text, the text you were looking at would be readable, and the text as you went peripherally to the text you were reading, it became its true size. Mm-hmm. So you could see the context of it. It was for image analysis. I'm trying to remember. It was located down in Yale. Yes, exactly. Yeah, it was precisely like a magnifying glass. It was in Yale Town, name escapes me. But something like that on a cell phone would be wonderful, mm-hmm. because you wouldn't lose the context of a newspaper page, or you wouldn't lose the context of the image, but you could look at a picture and say, well, I want to see the face or the knees or whatever. So it's the sort of thing that needs people in WinBC, I guess, to get together and say, where are the opportunities? They would know a lot more than I would at this point as to where some of them might be. I'm just being very general here.
Sure. I guess my opinion is the technology is the easier piece, and putting together the distribution, the channels, the licensing.
Absolutely.
That's a much bigger challenge for a company than the technology.
Right. And bringing together, that's right. And so getting the resources to do it finding the compelling argument to pull those resources into it. It's always been the challenge that you see in these technology companies as well. We've got these resources now, where are we going to deploy them? And mm-hmm. and if you come up with something that's got perhaps such a short life as VanOck does, as much as we all like to think it's a great event, mm-hmm. It's tough to really pin a business around it. Where's the residual? What's that really going to come from?
Yeah, there was a presentation that WinBC put on about the Olympics coming up, and part of the message was you're not going to develop something specifically for the event because it's a short-lived event, and it's not something you can create a business around, but if you have a business that could be slanted that way.
Correct.
But keep in mind, right. The business needs to stand alone. It's not.
Yes.
It's not the Olympics. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Right. And it also backed into one of the things at ASI that we found was that often the undergraduate students come up with some absolutely brilliant ideas, mm-hmm. and practical ones, and so again, there's no agency really that would handle this today, as far as I know. But you know, if you could pull out the university. Capability, if you wish, and the enthusiasm and the fact that these students will work 20 hours a day, and if you could couple that with some of the backbone business areas that are in place, you might have some synergy. But I know from a little experience that it's a grand plan, but it somebody really has to be emboldened and run with it. And I'm not sure. Otherwise, it's way too easy for internal individuals who have their other things that they've got as issues, mm-hmm. to defeat it at the mm-hmm. at the allocation table. So. So anyway, I'm glad there's things like the lab, you know, the Wind Lab project going ahead and others, and it's the sort of thing that WinBC should mm-hmm. look at from time to time and see if there's an opportunity.
So are there any, we've been sort of dabbing around a little bit, and I'll probably need to piece this back together again. Are there any things I should ask you about, any amusing stories that we didn't cover off about some of the early experiences that I think it's a lot, bringing this sort of concept of, or the idea that I'm trying to advance, I think if you look at the technology map, it doesn't tell the story. It shows the connections, but
right.
But there's
doesn't put the human face to it.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It's the bringing to life, if you like.
Right.
Yes.
Right. Hmm. It's tough, and I don't have specific stories, but I think if you start with that tech map, and I essentially got parachuted into it, so I didn't come from, Circuit Graphics and the other companies and the LDevCos and sort of thing, but it's worthwhile giving some prominence or credit, if you wish, to people like. John McDonald, who you're going to meet, obviously, and for him, and then Bill Thompson, who's no longer with us, and Purdy, who's no longer here, and these guys. I mean, they were visionaries at their time, and another person who's still around, I believe, is Gordon English, right?
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at the Ventures West list of investees,
mm-hmm.
that sort of have gone through. Well, MDA is one, MDI is one. And Gordon English's thing was, what was it? It was he sold Control Systems.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't remember his company's name. But these people were all leaders,
yes.
Right? And mm-hmm. from those spawned all sorts of things. And MDI, I think you're going to, if you talk to Barclay and others, you'll hear all sorts of stories, and I mean, there were parties and socials and goodness knows what, and that was true digital equipment was a wild place, and you had lots of young people and lots of energy, and so it was a good time. It was a really busy, heady time. We have a sort of a slightly, we have a different world here. We have disruptive technologies. We have internet. We have a whole number. These were all happening, and so,
mm-hmm.
so one of the interesting things, if you go back as far as you're going, into the 80s, we're talking 30 years here. It's a short term, but it's very hard. It's very hard to remove current experience
mm-hmm.
or approach. In looking at what was then, you keep thinking, well, of course he did this and that, but you don't realize that this chip story, right, of Barclay coming into the board meeting, saying, well, we had to fly someone to Taiwan and bring those chips and fly them back in a suitcase, that sort of stuff, and the deals we had with the Royal Bank and small things like that all made this work, and it's, I think it's the human. It's the human interactions, right? I mean, there was this person at Federal Express. I'm trying to remember his name. I should. And, he'd been looking for this problem. Is how do I digitally control these trucks out there and know what they're doing? There wasn't GPS at that time.
Yes.
Right? There was nothing you could use.
Yeah.
So people today, they can have GPS in something the size of this recorder. So. So it's not. It doesn't sound. So what do you? You're tracking a truck. So what? Everybody does it. But we're talking here. If you're going back to the history in the 80s and 90s,
mm-hmm.
this is pre 2000. It was a different. It was a very different world.
Yeah.
So then it's the people side of it is certainly true, and And there were, a whole number of just, Dennis Connor, Dennis is just a luminary, right? Mm-hmm. And he's played a significant role through many, many years and many projects at MDNA. And so, and John's story is fascinating, coming out of Prince Rupert and things he looked at. And, so there's all sorts of stories. But
so do you think it's easier today, now there's more technology than there was in those days? Or do you think it's less fun than it used to be because it was so pioneering at the time?
Good question. I'm sure the people in it wouldn't say it's less fun. They're having a blast, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, there's huge opportunities and huge demand for skilled people. So, anyone who's a good software programmer is surely snap. Although, 3 or 4 years ago, it was a little slow. So,
yes.
So today it's pretty much a booming world. I think it is certainly more complex. In terms of the partnerships and the alliances that you have out there,
mm-hmm.
and the strategies for entry, they're certainly more complex. It was, mm-hmm. it seemed as though it was perhaps. It seems in retrospect that those were more of a technical challenge than the peripheral. Whereas now, there's a technical challenge, but as we just mentioned in terms of the VanOck opportunity,
yes.
sure, but then you've got licensing, and you've got this, and you've got that, and you've
yes.
got a whole number of other things.
Mm-hmm.
To partly combat that, you have the ease of use of the web and SMS. I mean, you can just go on SMS. You get anybody instantaneously
mm-hmm.
that you need. So there's some tools that counteract it, but I think it is a more complex, definitely a more complex world in terms of building the business and the strategies. And I think for Canadian and BC companies in particular, we have this terrible problem of growing something of size.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Sierra Wireless is one of the few, that's managed to
yes.
sort of stay here, not being taken, because it's inessentially a niche, and
mm-hmm.
it's done very well. It got its nose bloodied when it tried to come up with a,
mm-hmm.
A palm lookalike, and
right.
I had to walk
yes.
away from that. But it's in the research area,
mm-hmm.
it's certainly good. And I guess in my other, one of the things I did at ASI was to champion the arena of nanotechnology,
mm-hmm.
and that's emerges a really mm-hmm. I have a strong interest in the arena, and it's in discussing that with people in Japan and the U.S. and elsewhere. I mean, BC has a great recognition, receives great recognition for its research and
mm-hmm.
capabilities and its innovation, but it doesn't, it's not really on the radar when it comes
mm-hmm.
to manufacturing.
Mm-hmm.
So it's
and certainly growing
challenge.
Growing companies to reasonable size. For instance, WinBC, I know, has several, probably 200 members,
right.
but they're all small company, so it's the exception, like the Sierra Wireless, that stands out there.
Correct. Yeah, I mean, there's a one blip, and
yeah.
Creo was the first $1 billion sales company,
mm-hmm.
and got there by some acquisitions, but nevertheless,
mm-hmm.
head office here, right,
yes.
and now part of Kodak. So, you lose these things as the main drivers, although then they spin off some people as the tech map shows. So,
mm-hmm.
It's a challenge for Canada. There's no doubt. But we get all this wonderful recognition when you go to Japan. Oh yes, great things. We want to come and see what you're doing. But they only see it as an embedded part of a solution,
right. yes.
as opposed to as something that you're really manufacturing here. Fuel cells, we seem to be making a bit of headway, particularly in the more miniature fuel cells, and I think without some major government assistance, we wouldn't see the fuel cell buses
mm.
and this sort of thing. But it's certainly we've got some tremendous talent, technology in that arena here too.
So, do you think nanotechnology is now the new pioneering front, or where is it at?
It's simple to say yes,
mm-hmm.
But it's unlike other technologies such as life science or biotech. It's very much an enabling embedded technology across many, many sectors.
Mm-hmm.
For some people, they'll say, well, that's just chemistry.
Mm-hmm.
It's different. There are some differences, I think, in the way that people look at self-assembly and interactions, and just being able to manipulate and control at that scale, as opposed to have a reaction, which is clearly involving nanoscale interactions, but all you're looking at is the black box effect of it. The Woodrow Wilson Institute in Washington did a study about 2 years ago, and they came out with about 223 or 226 consumer products that had a nano component to them. Mm-hmm. They've recently redone that. It's up around 400 now. Mm-hmm. So, and escalating. So the embedded nature of it is showing up across a wide range of consumer products, and they're, you know, the U.S. and Japan and Europe are all spending about $1 billion a year in research. Alberta's just announced $130 million into nanotech. Mm-hmm. BC has just, you know, a really embryonic organization, but it has, I guess, around probably about $160 million of invested infrastructure if you combine, you know, NSERC and other grants that have gone into the universities. Uh-huh. 40 labs out at Simon Fraser is a is a world class set up for doing research. Now, mm-hmm. it's academic, so yes. So how do you pull that? Mm-hmm. How do you pull those findings out and get them into the real world? Frank Coe has just taken over as head of AMPEL, the Advanced Material Processing Engineering Lab at UBC. He comes from a very interesting background. Done some work for NASA, you know, working with Boeing, etc. And so I think you're going to see a bit of a push here to engineer products and engineer products into the real world. So I think there's a huge opportunity for it. It's continually showing up in a whole range of opportunities. And in fact, in the venture capital world, just reading some things recently, the venture capital world is a little standoffish for a while as to, well, what does this all mean, and it's still in the labs, it's still a science, mm-hmm. but
yeah.
You are beginning to see a turn of the tide there, mm-hmm. and people are now predicting that you're going to see some of these really interesting IPOs that are mm-hmm. that are nanotech based. Nanosys, for example, pulled its IPO a year and a half ago or so mm-hmm. for market conditions, mm-hmm. and the pundits are now saying, well, we're going to see maybe that or others that are going to come out and go public, and you'll begin to see a strong interest in investment in applications of nanomaterials, nanotechnologies, you know, which is a term some people dislike. Other people say, look, it's going to become so endemic that you won't even use it anymore. It'll just be a technology. Mm-hmm. So you won't call it nano, but. The opportunities for it, I think, are tremendous. I mean, for example, the forest industry here has done a study already in nanotechnology, mm-hmm. and the interlap or the overlap there is essentially what you do, or how you make money out of the forest products, is what you do with the fiber, mm-hmm. and what you do with the fiber is determined, and the characteristics of the fiber is determined at the nanoscale. And so you want to get down to cellulose at the nanoscale before you do what you want to do with it. Pregnancy tests are much more accurate and responsive using nanogold mm-hmm. as opposed to gold. So in fact, that antibody has a little bit of nanogold attached mm-hmm. to the end of it, and that's your indicator. So you're seeing, so many materials just respond totally different at the nanoscale mm-hmm. than the other ones. Catalyst, platinum. Platinum as a catalyst is significantly more reactive than platinum as it's currently used mm-hmm. or has been employed in catalytic reactors in cars.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So you've got some really huge opportunities, and then along with that, and lagging, I might add, are the studies on toxicity and transport, embeddedness mm-hmm. and manufacturing capabilities, and mm-hmm. What mm-hmm. substrate do you use to move nanotubes around? And I was in a university lab a couple of weeks ago, and there was a little cylinder. I said, yeah, well, that's carbon nanotubes, and it was like a little film canister and transparent, and we both joked and said, well, don't open it, because it'll just, you know, it's, you're talking particles that are so fine, it'll just float off in the air, mm-hmm. right? So, but there it is, and, you know, sort of very casually sitting on the corner of a desk. But I think we're going to see a great deal of opportunity in that arena. Just bringing things down to working, I don't know if nano is the right word, but working at in the range of the very small.
Yes, right.
Everything is coming down to saying, I mean, well, the processes in that computer is hundreds of them that you know, or the functionality is there, and the size is there, and the weight is there because of things that are laid down at the nanoscale.
Mm-hmm.
And so you know, that's already in existence. So I think the world of nanotechnology is the newer is new arenas where people are looking at nanomaterials, nanoclays, artificial switches and things, and it's all becoming embedded in products.
I guess one of the aspects of the computer, of course, is the Moore's Law and driving down the density and requiring new technology in order to get the scale small, to get the speeds higher, and so on. So I don't know if nanotechnology is going to play in that. I would assume working at those very small scales or learning how to do that is important.
Oh, it's crucial, absolutely crucial. Well, you heard that D-Wave ran a 16-qubit machine.
Yes.
So they've demonstrated that. They have to run it at near absolute zero.
Mm-hmm.
So they have cooling questions, engineering questions. But I just can't believe that there won't be significant spin-offs that come into diverse areas. Right now we're seeing nano coatings on a whole range of materials. Inco's new nickel plant that's putting into New Caledonia, for example, has ball valves and things all going to be coated with a nano coating, right? Because it's a very corrosive environment. And there's a Nova, which is a chemical plant, Nova Chemicals. They have main reactor vessels that are all treated and all coated with a nano coating, which is in fact not a single coating, but it's multiple layers at the nano scale. Again, reducing wear, reducing heat issues, and significantly extending the life between teardowns of their reactor vessels. So these are, they're not romantic stories, but they're practical applications that you're seeing in a whole number of things. And nano silver, again, is another component that we're going to see more of. And there are people working out at UBC on wearable electronics and printable electronics. So it's a fantastic world, and we're going to see a great opportunity there. But it's not an industry. That's the problem. It's so diverse. But but the BC researchers are doing a great deal on it. And in fact, if you visit the NanoBC website, there's a recent study of about 100 researchers in all of their areas and interests and focus. So it's an extension of that.
Yeah, it's interesting to think about how that will become a business rather than research community, which is what it is right now, and I think, as you said, it's going to be a lot of core technology rather than product that people will have visibility to.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, nano zinc shows up in your transparent sunscreen, but you don't, you know, other than the fact that you might choose to have something that's not a white cream on your face, you just go and buy it off the shelf, right? And but that's the component that works in it. So there's very much an embedded nature to it.
Well, I think we should wrap it up.
Sure.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's great.
Allowing me to ramble on and
yeah.
revisit some distant past. That's